Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com. Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Hi, I'm John McEnroe.
I'm Bjorn Borg.
This is Martina Navratilova.
I'm Mats Wilander.
I'm Stan Wawrinka.
I'm Leighton Hewitt.
I'm Andy Murray.
And you're listening to the Tennis Podcast.
Well, you join us this week in the dressing room of Catherine Whittaker here at Prime Video. I'm backstage, Catherine. Wow, this is good, isn't it?
You are so privileged.
I know.
Right now.
It's very exciting. And we're here. We've got the telly on, which Catherine will be on in a minute. And she'll be presenting the aftermath of the Novak Djokovic against Rafael Nadal Rome final, which is currently taking place. We're midway through the second set as we come to you after this startling bagel set for Rafael Nadal in the first set. We'll get on to all that in a little while. But I've just come over from BT Sport, where I've been commentating on the women's final and the women's tournament all week long, which has resulted in a title for Karolina Pliskova over Johanna Konta. And to be honest, either one of those players, they're just not players I expected to see in the final.
No, maybe we should have expected to see Karolina Pliskova. I don't know. I mean, I'm not sure anybody, even after her run to the final in Rabat, expected to see Jo Konta there. Probably not even Jo Konta. I mean, she said winning that semi-final against Kiki Bertens was the biggest result she's had since winning Miami back in 2017. Mm. No, since reaching the Wimbledon semi-final, yes. Also in 2017.
That's it.
That was, that was peak Jo Konta, wasn't it? So that shows the significance of reaching that final. But maybe we should have been thinking of Pliskova.
But
Did we talk about Pliskova enough?
Well,
I don't know.
And that was the point being made, is why is Karolina Pliskova, I think it was in our questions and answers show when we were talking about who's the best, the most underrated player, or who's the best player not to have won a slam, that kind of thing. She has not won a slam yet. She's obviously an incredibly talented player, but for whatever reason, she isn't a player I don't think I've ever picked her to win a slam. She's reached a final, and she never kind of comes to the front of my mind. I would say much more so now, given the season she is having, that is, I think, is now 6 out of 8 tournaments where she's reached the quarterfinals or better. This is the first time, certainly in about 3 years, where she's really put it together consistently, and she looks like a player who does not want to leave a stone unturned in her career.
Yeah, I've always thought of her as quite consistent. Maybe the numbers don't back that up. I mean, I will always pick her to reach a quarter or a semi. I'll just never usually pick her to win a slam. I think I had her in my Wimbledon final a couple of years ago,
where she's never done any good.
Where she's never... I think maybe that's why she's a little bit overlooked, because I feel like she should have had results at Wimbledon. She should have been a massive feature at Wimbledon the last 5 years.
Last year, she just hasn't been. Fourth round was her best she'd ever done. She'd never gone beyond the second round of Wimbledon until last year.
I mean, John Isner had a similar record, didn't he, before last year, obviously, when he bored us all to death with Kevin Anderson.
Poor old John.
Sorry, mate, but I mean, that's not an experience anyone wants to relive, is it? Well, you were in the commentary booth, weren't you?
And fortunately not.
Were you not?
Stars make matches, I think it's fair to say. And Kevin Anderson against John is... I mean, look, either one of those two players against either one of the two that we're watching right now...
Oh, yeah, it's just that matchup was deathly.
But I've always thought that
and
about
when, and happened to go
styles.
On forever.
I always think that with... Actually, you know, you put Karolina Pliskova against Simona Halep, for instance, or someone like that. I like those sort of matchups. But for her to have not gone beyond the second round for several years at Wimbledon is just a strange kind of stat, given the serve she has. She has served, again, more aces than anybody in the world this year in the women's game. I was talking to Annabelle Croft today in commentary. She just says she has almost the perfect service motion. There is not one little kink in that serve. And I don't get how you don't produce on grass with that kind of game. She's reached a semi-final at the French Open, but she's never gone beyond the last 16 at Wimbledon. The only thing I wonder is whether, a bit like Richard Krajicek, who also didn't get past the third round for years and then suddenly won the thing, maybe it's just going to...
She's going to suddenly win Wimbledon. Didn't you say Ash Barty was going to win Wimbledon, though?
Well, I did say that, yeah. No, but I haven't actually picked Pliskova. I've picked Barty to win a slam this year, haven't I?
Well, as I think we're raking over old turf now, but you've got to pick one of the three then.
Well, yes. No, I've got to, she's got to win one of the three.
Another stat for you. Jo Konta's never won a match at the French Open.
I know. That is weird, isn't it?
Isn't it?
She, and I was looking at them. It's 4 years in a row now. The last one was Yulia Putintseva. She lost to in the first round.
Oh, I watched that live. That was a messy tussle.
Yeah, she had that very tough one against Shea Suwei, which I think she had a tie break to win it in the second set and didn't, and then ended up losing that. Denisa Alatova, she lost in the first round, having qualified. That was her first go at it in 2015, having got into the main draw. Can't remember who she lost to, the other one of the four. But this year, she's now won more clay court matches than all the 3 years previously combined.
And how much is it down to Fed Cup? I think a lot.
I think
because
you're
right, confidence is everything for Konta, isn't it? I mean, she's got one game plan, and when it's on, it's great. I love it. It's so gutsy, and it can be a bit route one, but it's there's no holds barred. You know, it's shameless drilling of a tennis ball, and you know, I think she's come under fire for not having a plan B, but her response to that is always, I know what my strengths are, I know what I'm good at, I know that when I'm on, it's good enough to beat most players in the world. It's just, you know, she's been on a bit less over the last 12 to 18 months than she has before, but with that style of play, low margin style of play, confidence is everything. And we know she, you know, sort of personality wise we talked about her being sort of an introvert in the past, and I think that it getting herself in the right frame of mind doesn't come as naturally as it does to some other players. So an experience like the Fed Cup, I think, is just enormous for her.
Yeah, well, what was happening there is she was having to win despite things not going well, and I think that's done her the world of good. I think it also shows what a fighter she is. She will not give it in until the very last ball. And she has her ways of dealing and compartmentalising every single point. And that's, you know, over the years, the British media, we've slightly chuckled at her talk of processes, but it makes total sense, really, doesn't it? To just strip down the reality of your day job into the bits that you can control every single time you do anything, rather than worrying about big picture stuff that those processes contribute towards.
Yeah, it doesn't come naturally to her. She's not Rafael Nadal. She doesn't wake up in the morning feeling in the zone for a tennis match.
She Who does?
she has to trick her mind.
Yeah.
She has to have tools to get herself in the right headspace for a tennis match. And those tools don't make for good interview fodder. But if, you know, if they get her to the Rome final.
Well, the other thing that she has been doing, though, this week, which I haven't really seen as much of, and I saw it at the Fed Cup as well, the sheer number of drop shots she was hitting against Markéta Vondrousova, who is a bit of
the new drop shot dragon.
Yeah. Oh, wow. Her and Albert Porter, she's been going to his school, I think. She hit one every shot, every single rally against Daria Kasatkina did Vondrousova.
Such a great match.
It was a wonderful match. It was played on the Pietrangeli court, which is the third main court in Rome. I think that they should use it way more for night matches. If the place was packed, people were chanting Vondrousova's name.
Is it a health and safety issue that they don't?
I would imagine. I mean, it's a small court. It used to be the centre court many years ago until they built the big new one.
And it's not even individual seats, is it? It's just sort of marbled bench style seating.
You couldn't put Nadal, Federer and Djokovic on those courts, I don't think, without...
They put Fanini Tsitsipas on it.
Did they?
That was riotous.
Yes. Okay, well, we'll get onto that in a minute. But just on the subject of the drop shots that Konta was hitting against Vondrousova, it was... I just found it really interesting that she got in there first. You know, here's a woman who we're expecting to hit countless drop shots, and Konta just got in there first, and she
not on your Nelly.
I made a really good job of it, and so I think she has added to her game, and I just think she needs to win one match at the French Open, and then with a half decent draw, she could really make a run.
She's going to be seeded now, isn't she? Up to 26 in the world as a result of this week.
Yeah. What about Pliskova? Do you feel? I mean, like she was saying that
she's in the mix, David. She's in that mix.
Blimey hell, Matt. What have you done? I feel like she...
He's been dropped from the pod this week due to creation of the mix.
Yes. We've removed one of the ingredients of the podcast mix. She said that she didn't feel like she'd played that well, and she was in the final. And then suddenly in the final, she started to serve well. In the first set, she had 90% first serves in with that serve. But the big factor... that I think that is different. I mean, she was kind of joint coached last year, wasn't she, by Renee Stubbs and Conchita Martinez. Now it's just Martinez who, whenever she comes onto the court, you end up feeling invigorated as a spectator, let alone a player.
I love their dynamic. I really do.
She was saying, actually, in her press conference yesterday that I think Ben Rothenberg asked... the sheer number of questions or bits of information you get given by Martinez, is it possible to take all of it in? And she said, honestly, I kind of take the bits I feel I need, so I do listen to it all. It's not like I'm ignoring it, I'm listening to it all, but there is a lot, and I just want certain bits of it. I want to hear it all and then choose. And but I think the main thing is she doesn't allow Pliskova to let down. She went a set down to two really feisty competitors in Sofia Kenin and Victoria Azarenka. I mean, you have to play well to turn that around against those two. And mentally, she was there the whole time. And I feel as though she's got, obviously, huge respect for Martinez, who's won this title four times herself before. And she just feels good when she comes out into the court. It feels right. She knows that she's getting the right information and from a person that has been there and done it. And the vibe is really good.
Martin has won four Rome titles.
Yeah, four in a row between 1993 and 96, I think it was.
Because I think of her as Conchita Martinez, Wimbledon champion.
Yeah.
But,
well, that was the outlier, really. Yeah. She was a clay court specialist with a loopy game and somehow managed to beat Martina Navratilova in a Wimbledon final with some of the best returns you've ever seen. So I think one of the other factors that will be very interesting at the French Open is Martinez can't come on the court. And will she be able to do it on her own?
Same with Kiki Buttons and Raymond Sluiter, I think, Sluiter.
I tell you, honestly, this week alone, I've called him four names. Slouter, Sluiter, Sluiter.
Greg says Sluiter, and bless him, there's lots of great things about Greg Rozetsky's contribution to the tennis broadcasting world, but name pronunciations is rarely one of them. So if Greg's saying Sluiter, I'm going Sluiter or Sluiter.
Let's call the whole thing off.
Sluiter. I'm going Sluiter. I'm confidently going Sluiter.
Right, okay. Right, I'm going to get in touch with him. I mean, I don't want to name drop here. Is it name dropping if you name drop Raymond?
Is it name dropping to say I'm going to contact Raymond Sluiter?
Raymond, be by your phone. I'm coming.
Yeah, same with her, because I love their dynamic too. I want him in my phone book just to be available to guide me through life.
He's a lovely bloke.
He's just got a way about him, hasn't he? He's got a lovely aura and a heck of a lot of good tactical input as well. But that is a chat. I mean, I love that extra element of intrigue. On the men's side, you have the fact that it's best of five that elevates the challenge of a Grand Slam above what they do week in, week out. Well, this is something I think that elevates the challenge and adds a new dimension to it on the women's side.
It does. But
you know, the better the coach, the more you depend on them. And
still disappointing that you end up with this situation of it not being available at the slams, because then you remove that element. And I don't know, that just bothers me.
Yeah, I mean, I've said it before, I'll say it again. Consistency, if we think coaching is on-court coaching is a good thing, and I by and large do, then let's do it across the board, every tournament, men's and women's. Let's do it.
Annabelle Croft likes it, by the way. She doesn't like.
Shall I get her and Joe Jury head to head on it at the French Open?
Yeah, I want to hear that debate.
Joe hates it.
I know. Most people do. And most people, ex-players do.
Yeah.
But the other thing that Annabelle really spoke strongly about was injury timeouts, because Petra Kvitova, in a match against Maria Sakkari, who was fantastic this week, by the way, she got to the semi-finals. One set all, three love to Sakkari. Kvitova had an injury timeout for a calf issue, and she did retire a game later. It was clear injury. I mean, I don't think there was any attempt by Kvitova to bend the rules or to stop momentum. That's not her, at least my view of her. But it did stop the momentum, and there was an 8-minute break that Sakkari had to deal with. And Annabelle said, "I feel that you're either fit to play or you're not. And there should be no injury timeouts."
I don't agree. I see where she's coming from. I think the current rule that we have at the moment is you're right, it just doesn't feel right, that, does it? But I mean, presumably the diagnosis took 5 minutes, because you're not allowed more than 3 minutes for the actual timeout.
Yeah,
but you're allowed unlimited time for diagnosis of the injury. That is the problem. And I mean, if you change that, then you've got health and safety issues on your hands, haven't you? Because you cannot possibly rush a medical diagnosis, nor would you want to. But equally, on the other hand, I don't want to see a match stopped for a blister, a completely debilitating yet entirely and quickly treatable issue.
But surely you can treat your own blister.
But you probably need more than the sit down to do it. So whether you do it yourself or not, you still are going to some extent disrupt the momentum of the match. And if you're going to do that, why not get it done by a professional?
Because then you're getting help from outside, and it takes...
Okay, well, should you be able to get rackets strong?
Maybe you should just be allowed to use the sit down and nothing else, so that you can't disrupt your opponent's time.
Blister repair against the clock.
Yeah.
You can have a blister clock as next to the shot clock.
I think so. I can't remember whether it was...
Do you see my point, though?
Oh, totally.
I don't want to see a great match
called off
by the umpire. I'm sorry. Ash Barty was unable to get her socks back on in time after applying a blister plaster.
Yeah.
We're going to have to cancel this
match. I'll tell
you
what, though. I think it might have been Joe who said, well, maybe what should happen is you have... you lose points if you're going over certain time slots, you know?
Yeah, you could.
Just so that a player who is having treatment has to have some consequences in terms of time if they
The problem, though, is that there is a limit on the time for the treatment. That rule exists. It's the diagnosis time that is unlimited, and then you're putting the pressure on the medical professional, and that's not fair.
Mm.
I don't think we could get into a situation where we're putting pressures on physios and doctors to rush a diagnosis.
Annabelle Pat and Joe, they all say, well, we didn't have all this when we were playing.
Yeah, but I mean that's the you know, oh, the good old days.
But it's
don't
what
make
happened.
Me do Brexit comparisons.
It's
David.
What happened though, you know. And we
didn't
have
but
all that.
isn't it great that we're seeing the longevity of players extended now?
Yeah, that's true. Let us know what you think at Tennis Podcast on Twitter. Send us an email. Our website contact form is there. You can email us at tennispodcast.net. It's an interesting talking point, and one I suspect that will rumble on forever.
I certainly think it's worthy of some discussion because I mean. Yeah, it's so unscientific to talk about feel, but you're absolutely right. It didn't feel right.
And there are adjustments being made. We're looking at a shot clock on the side of the court during this Rome men's final at the moment. We're looking at, I read today that the French Open will only allow one bathroom break for players per set at the French Open. Things like that, you know, which...
Is that men's and women's?
I'm not sure. Actually, I can't remember. But anyway,
I would potentially have issues with that on the women's side.
Mm, I'm not sure, to be honest, Catherine.
Interesting.
Have to
we
check.
We will seek clarification.
We will. Maybe Raymond Slater knows about that as well. Anyway, whatever his name is. So the rest of the week in Rome, we saw victory once again. I mentioned Marketa Vondrousova, who got her second win of the year over Simona Halep. And she just drop-shotted her into oblivion. Plus, Halep was incredibly complimentary about how good Vondrousova was on the stretch, out wide to either her forehand or backhand. She had an ability to slice under defence. I was so impressed with this woman. She's 19 years of age. And now we've known about her for a couple of years.
She had a big result at the US Open last year, didn't she?
Do you know, I can't remember what she
did
at the slams.
Stand by, David. Keep
okay.
talking.
But
keep
what talking, she did do, Google. She beat Konta last year at Indian Wells, and she has got to 44 in the world. She won. You know, she won a title in her second professional event as a 17-year-old. But this was the first time that I've really watched her closely. She's a left-hander, and seeing her on clay, it just felt like you really get to see her full repertoire. And to play against Daria Kasatkina, who's a kind of similar player, isn't she? Very expansive and extravagant spins and paints pitches. And it was just a beautiful sight to watch this woman in action, a really natural tennis player.
She beat Kiki Bertens.
Goodness.
13th seed. 7-6 in the third, no less. She got to the round of 16 and lost out to Alicia Sorenko.
Yeah. Well, I think she's going places, Vondrousova, based on what I saw this week. I really think she is a serious player, just a natural tennis player. And she's got a bit of a serve on her as well, which Kasatkina looked like a dolly of a serve by comparison.
I love that Annabelle in commentary described her drop shotting as just tennis's best wind up.
Yeah, it was. Because against Kasatkina, literally every rally is finishing with a drop shot, which is it does wind you up. So that was very good. The rest of the week, I mean, I mentioned Halep because I kind of feel like we look at her as the French Open favourite and yet she didn't win. Well, Kiki Bertens lost to Jo Konta in the semis. I mean, who is the French Open favourite? Who is it? I'd still go Halep.
Would you?
Just.
Yeah, Halep, but it's definitely the field.
Yeah, well, yeah, obviously.
Is Halep probably more than any other individual? But
interesting.
I mean, Osaka pulled out of her quarterfinal with a hand injury, didn't she? But a slightly bizarre injury. She said she woke up. She said she felt absolutely fine the day before. Woke up that morning and her thumb was numb.
Playing well though, isn't she?
Yeah, she is playing really well.
I mean, you know, you said at the start of the year, it'll be interesting to see her on clay because that's not where her best results have come. And yet, she's won the last two slams. They had this, if you didn't follow it this week, they had the most biblical rain you've ever seen in your life on Wednesday, which I think ended up being the first washout in the tournament's history that did not get a ball hit. It did mean that on Thursday you had 50-odd matches being played. You had Nadal, Federer, Djokovic all playing on the second court, all having to play twice in a day. And Osaka was beating good players. You know, she is able to transfer her game a little bit like Konta was doing today, and which also Pliskova does. These players, if they're good enough, they can transfer their hard court games onto the clay, which I find very interesting.
Yeah, it seems so. It seems so much more possible that now than it did 10, 15 years ago. The concept of clay court specialists, I think, is slightly fading.
Mm.
I mean, it was only a year ago that I thought of Kiki Bertens as a clay court specialist, and she's, you know, so clearly not. She's, I mean, she had success on grass last year, didn't she?
Christine Garin, I'm told. Proper clay court specialist.
Who we know all about now.
Yeah, well, we're going to keep a beady eye and find out.
I mean, can you think of someone you'd call a proper clay court specialist in the women's game?
Maybe Carla Suarez Navarro a little bit, but she's also reached the Miami final
US
in her
Open
career.
Quarterfinalist last year.
Yeah. Did she do that last year?
You commentated on it, David, didn't you?
I don't know.
Madison Keys?
I can't remember.
That really bizarre match on the Friday night where no one was paying any attention.
I'll take your word for it.
Maybe it wasn't a quarterfinal. You definitely commentated on it with Annabelle.
Yeah.
And Annabelle was appalled that...
Yes, she was appalled.
Nobody was
watching.
But I
don't think it was a quarterfinal. No. I think it was halfway through the event.
Oh.
Yeah.
Well, if it was a Friday, then it was either the semi-final or...
But look,
like a second round.
Suarez Navarro certainly has had results on other surfaces. You're quite right. And yeah, the concept of it is not what it used to be. There are not many Sergio Bergueras, and frankly... But then, you know, you look back... We've just been talking about Conchita Martinez. Back in the day, you would not have got a player that you described more as a clay court specialist than Conchita Martinez, and yet she won Wimbledon.
True. Likewise, Rafael Nadal, back in the day. The time that he won his first Wimbledon, you would still have described him as a clay court specialist.
Mm.
Not Svitolina. I'll take it back before I even said it.
She can do whatever
I'm going
she
through
wants.
The drawer and seeing if I can... identify one. There's somebody called Elisabetta Cocchiaretto, who I've never heard of before, but could well be a clay court specialist. Sara Errani.
Tell you what, old Carla Suarez Navarro did reach the quarterfinals of US Open last year.
Come on.
Blimey heck. Good work. I don't know who she played. But anyway, yes, it's all happening. So the other player I feel like we should talk about, not a clay court specialist, is Serena Williams, who made her long-awaited comeback. Last time she'd played was Miami, and she played Rebecca Peterson there. She played her here. She beat her and played pretty well. And she told us quite interestingly about the kind of health kick that she's on at the moment to keep herself in the best shape she can be in. And then sadly, she was forced to withdraw ahead of her match with her sister Venus. I think it's the ongoing knee injury, isn't it?
Ongoing knee injury is literally the terminology that was used in the statement. I don't know what to say because I just have no idea where Serena Williams is at. I mean, what can we say? We've seen her play Rebecca Peterson.
There's no evidence,
and I don't
there?
Know what conclusions I can draw. Mm. On that basis, she arrived in Rome really early, didn't she? She seemed to be bigging up her sort of, you know, yeah, this is where my clay court season begins. She loves Rome, doesn't she? It's where she met her husband. And then it was just this big damp squib. So I don't know.
Mm. Well, I really hope she can just find enough fitness to play properly again, because the ball striking is there. That's the really frustrating thing. It's all there. It just needs, like these top male players, and particularly I think of Nadal, just needs them to be fit in order to keep on producing it.
You still think she'll break Margaret Court's record?
Yes, I do. I think there will be a period where she can get that fitness right. The ball striking is so good. And when she's playing well, she's moving well enough. It's just, yes, I do. I do. What do you think?
Yeah, I think she'll get one more.
Right, okay. Well, let's wait until the end of this match, shall we? And then we can talk about what happened.
Yeah, should we do a live out-of-date update?
Yeah, it's currently 6-love Nadal, 5-4 Djokovic juice.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, Tennis Podcast listeners. David here. Now, you might know that I love a bit of cooking, and I think I'm quite good at it. But if I'm honest, even I get fed up trying to work out what to do every night. That's where Home Chef comes in. Being able to put together a delicious meal without the long prep and the cook times, well, that's pretty cool. Home Chef provides fresh ingredients and chef-designed recipes conveniently delivered to your doorstep to simplify your cooking experience. They have over 30 options a week and serve a variety of dietary needs, so you don't have to worry about what to make ahead of time. Not only is it convenient, but it's economical too. Home Chef customers save an average of $86 per month on groceries. Now, for a limited time, Home Chef is offering Tennis Podcast listeners 18 free meals plus free dessert for life and, of course, free shipping on your very first box. Go to homechef.com/tennis. That's homechef.com/tennis for 18 free meals and free dessert for life. You heard it right. So Rafael Nadal is the Rome champion. He went on to win it in three sets, despite the fact that Novak Djokovic somehow managed to win that second set. Don't quite know how. You join us now with Catherine Whittaker and myself, David Law, in a car. We are heading back to sunny Putney, home of the Putney Exchange, where Catherine lives and where I'm staying at a local hotel. And yes, well, what do we make of all that we have just witnessed? Because we've had a six love set. We referenced it briefly in passing, Catherine, but that is quite a shock on paper. But is it a shock in reality, given the difference in their preparation for this particular match and their turnaround time after their semi-finals?
Well, I guess not. I mean, I've just come off air with a number of pundits, Greg Rosetsky and Sam Smith in the studio, and commentators out there on site in Rome, and all of them seem to see the narrative of that match as Djokovic was too tired to really challenge Nadal, and it was only sort of sheer will that enabled him to take that second set. And that was, I agree, that seemed to be the case to me. His first line in the speech, which I was having someone translate in my ear, which I then had to relay on the air.
No, you shouldn't have told us that, Catherine. We were all thinking, gosh, she speaks...
I wasn't fooling anyone. And then flipping Nadal steps up there and starts speaking Italian, so I have to do the same thing again. No, the first thing he said was, I'm not going to talk about being tired, thereby talking about being tired. or at least mentioning being tired. And yeah, look, I mean, he was tired. He was doing everything he could to try and keep points as short as possible. He was at the net a lot. He was drop-shotting persistently despite having sort of a 0% return rate. He started moonballing midway through the first set, which was extraordinary. He was out of ideas. But for me, that raises the question of, okay, yes, he played a lot more tennis. I think there was a disparity of about 3 hours in the amount of tennis they'd each played since Friday, and Djokovic had had the less beneficial scheduling. He played his semi-final late at night on Saturday, finished about 10:30 local time, I think, so about 17 hour turnaround before the final. But
plus a 1 a.m. finish against Del Potro.
Plus a 1 a.m. finish against Del Potro the night before. Yes, all of that is punishing, and it wasn't a level playing field. However, I was a bit surprised by how knackered Djokovic was. I mean, this is the marathon man. This is the guy that beat Nadal in 6 hours in the Australian Open final in 2012, after having had a five-hour battle with Andy Murray the round before, okay, you get a day off in between rounds at Slams, but it, also it's over best of five at Slams. They've been winning these Masters titles with marathon battles and minimal recovery time for 10 to 15 years. So, yeah, Nadal was helped along by Djokovic being seemingly exhausted today, but it does put a speck of doubt in my mind about where Djokovic is at physically if he does get embroiled in a long match, which he could well do at Roland Garros.
I would think the bigger concern is probably the more cumulative effect of several matches of that ilk, because let's not forget he had two successive three-set matches against Del Potro, finishes at 1 a.m, comes out, plays another three-set match, pretty energetic matches against Diego Schwartzman. Then he's got to face the greatest clay court player of all time.
How many times have we seen that scenario and Djokovic has come out and defied gravity?
He made a slow start, but I would say actually he still defied gravity, but he did it in the second set, because Boris Becker tweeted at the end of the final, his only chance really is to make a good start on this surface against Nadal, and he didn't. He didn't make a good start. Nadal, worth saying how well he played, and
he was brilliant.
I'm not sure who it was in the studio, maybe all of you, just acknowledging the way he was going down the lines relentlessly, wasn't just trading cross court with Djokovic. He was doing, in a way, to Nadal, to Djokovic, what he does to him.
Yeah, that's a really good point, and not allowing Djokovic to take the ball as early as he would like. He was pushing him back and back and back. He was serving well. I think that's something that's been a bit errant in recent weeks. And the satisfaction and the joy on his face when he won, I feel like that's one of the most significant titles for him outside of the Slams in recent years. Really do. That he just was beside himself with joy. Couldn't stop smiling. Couldn't hold it in.
He needed that, didn't he?
Yeah.
I think he needed it as... I think there was a stat that Nick Lester gave that it was the longest title drought in something like...
Since 2004.
Yeah, and what a stat. And the... Just... He needed to know that he could win again at the very highest level. Just even the greatest need a reminder that their form is there going into the big one. And... what we all want to know, I suppose, is given what happened at the Australian Open, how big a deal is it to do it against Djokovic? He didn't want to play that game. He wanted to talk about how he needed to know that his game was there. And then the rest, well, whatever will be.
But how can you know your game is really there unless it's been tested against the best?
Yeah. I feel like for him, it is actually... He's not the sort to play the game, but I think it's significant because... It was such a chastening defeat to Djokovic. He needed to know that he could hurt him. And
yeah,
he hurt him today.
I agree. Yeah, he did hurt him. I think that defeat will sting a bit. I think, look, Djokovic is still going into the French Open with a title under his belt. They've each won one title. But generally, all other things being equal, Rome is a bigger indicator for Roland Garros due to the similarity in conditions than is Madrid.
Yeah, I've always typically thought that this week has been so strange with all, and maybe even the rain is a good indicator as well, because you have sometimes to deal with those conditions in Paris. But it made it so soft, it seemed, and the clay surface didn't feel that true this week. You know, there was a lot of slipping around, there was a lot of broken courts.
Well, Djokovic last night against Schwartzman was asking for the court to be swept at every change of ends.
Wow.
Not just at the end of the sets. He wasn't happy at all with the state of the court. I can only assume that the extent of the rain is a factor. Federer wasn't happy, was he? We had grouchy Fed.
Yes.
Against Borna Coric. He still won, came back from two match points down to beat Borna Coric, but he was doing a lot of complaining. But he was complaining about the slippiness of the lines, I guess, because they were watering the court a lot, I think.
He's not used to clay court tennis. He's forgot what it's all about.
Yeah. What is this red stuff?
But he withdrew from his match against Tsitsipas. Just on the Djokovic-Nadal situation here, does it shift your view more generally, therefore? You said it gives you a speck of doubt over the form of Djokovic going into the French Open. Does it? I think you still had Nadal as the favourite anyway, didn't you?
I did, yes. And Djokovic is still my second favourite, so I guess nothing has changed other than I just feel a little bit more confident in those two things.
I still feel that the Djokovic will win the French Open, because I don't feel that he will have a situation like he's had today. There won't be any backdrop to look back on and think, oh, that's where he got exhausted.
I have lost from a very low base. I have lost confidence in your predictions today, though, David.
What do you mean?
I mean that after the second set of the final, you said to me, Djokovic's going to steamroller him now.
Yeah, okay, yeah, I did say that.
With such a steely confidence. You almost had me believing it.
Well, I can't forget the Australian Open final. And I still feel from a level playing field that Djokovic's level is higher than Nadal's overall, if you take all the surfaces into account. And his record against him, what is it now, 28-26... He's been more dominant more recently.
28-26.
And that's where that came from. Now, I got it completely wrong, folks. What I would say is I did sort of think when he lost the first set, 6-love, I didn't think that that was automatically it as well.
You tweeted that.
Yeah, I did tweet that, thankfully.
And then after Djokovic won that second set, David got out his phone, pointed to that tweet and said, that was good, wasn't it?
So now Catherine has decided to just even it up here on the podcast. And fair enough. I still think that Djokovic will be different at the French Open. I think they're going to be top two seeds.
Yes.
They are. Yeah. I still think it'll go them in the final and it'll go all the way.
I do too. I just think it'll go all the way to La Duzima.
We haven't looked that up.
That's a work in progress, isn't it?
She can translate complete Italian speeches, but she can't do the numbers. So what about the rest of the week? Before we get on, there's a couple more points on the men's draw, and obviously we've got Kyrgios to talk about. But I did want to talk about Kiki Mladenovic, who has made it through to, what was it, the quarterfinals this week. She won some incredible matches along the way to get to, from a qualifying position. She beat Caroline Garcia. She was really excellent this week, and she's coached by Sasha Bayan now, who obviously had great success with Caroline Wozniacki, was part of Team Serena Williams for a long time, and then the most impactful of all, or at least the headline grab for everybody, is that he joined Team Naomi Osaka. She went and won two Grand Slam titles, became world number one, and then sacked him. So the reasons for which we've never known completely, we only know what was put out publicly, but he does seem to have an impact on the players he coaches in terms of the results they get.
Yeah, well, I mean, I don't want to take anything away from him as a coach, because that chat record you've just detailed speaks for itself, but it's a bit of an easy win with Kiki Mladenovic, isn't it? Because she's a former top 10 player that has been in the singles wilderness.
But why has she been in the singles wilderness?
I genuinely don't know.
64 in the world right now.
We were debating this the other day amongst ourselves, weren't we, with Matt, and I think we speculated that it was just sort of lack of desire, sort of a contentment with life, a lack of need to do what's required to be a consistent top 10 player. But it was such a vast drop off. I mean, I'm not saying Sasha will necessarily get her back into where she was. I think she got to number 9, didn't she? But I'd say to get her to being a top 25 player again is an easy win.
Yeah,
I would have thought
she's a really good player when she's on. But anyway, that's one last little bit that I forgot to mention in the first part of the show. Stefanos Tsitsipas continues to do well, although that was a pretty chastening defeat from Nadal. And there was a comment at the end of your coverage tonight by Sam Smith just reminding us of the chasm that is still there between the very best players in the world that have been dominating. What was that stat about 10 years ago and the quarterfinals in Rome, and they were still the same this year?
Yeah, 5 of the 8 men's quarterfinalists in Rome were the same as they were in 2009, and actually 2 of the matches were the same.
That was a grad maths stat, wasn't it?
Djokovic and Delpo and Nadal and Verdasco. Both of those were quarterfinals from 2009, and that was a grad maths stat, and it was an absolute corker.
Yeah, well done. And Sam Smith said that there's still such a distance. When they look at these two players today and over the last couple of days, they realise how far they've still got to go. Tsitsipas apart, because he is the one starting to bridge it.
Yeah, but I mean, I was so struck by that when I watched Shapovalov play Djokovic on... That was the first of Djokovic's 2 matches on Thursday. I just thought, what's he doing here? Like, he's just... He just so evidently had no chance at all at any stage of that match. There was not a moment where usually with those young players that are so talented and have none of the baggage and have nothing to lose, you think, oh, maybe, just maybe, maybe there'll be something exciting here. And I just didn't feel that for even a split second. And that's a problem. That's a problem, I think. The top players are improving, so just improving as a young player isn't enough, because you're not closing the gap. You've got to be improving leaps and bounds, and some of them are doing that, and most of them are still extremely young, and we shouldn't quite be hitting the panic button for them. But there are one or two that I've previously been very excited about that I now have a little bit of, come on, just
sort yourself out.
Yeah, just don't be a Dimitrov.
Oh,
I know,
hurts.
It's awful.
Dimitrov's not done yet. Quite.
What are you saying, David?
He's in the qualifying in Geneva.
Is he really?
He is, yeah.
He's playing qualies in Geneva.
Got a wild card into the qualies. Go on, Grigor. That's the way to do it. See, I like that. Go on,
I like that he's doing it, but that's a sorry state of affairs.
It is. Well, it does rock you, doesn't it?
Yeah.
When you realise that 18 months ago he was winning the ATP finals. It says a lot of how far he's fallen. Nick Kyrgios. Where do we start?
We're going to have to promote a rival podcast.
We
here,
are,
aren't we?
Because it was the No Challenges Remaining podcast presented.
Scored a coup.
Presented by Ben Rothenberg, who'd had a bit of a to and a fro with Nick Kyrgios over the last couple of years on Twitter. Quite entertaining, I have to say, on Twitter, that exchange. He ended up getting an interview in Rome with Kyrgios, which was warts and all, I think it is fair to say.
Warts and all, but not just his warts,
yeah,
other people's warts.
I think the slightly unfortunate thing is that there were some absolutely fascinating self-analysis in there, and reflections and insight into who he is and the way he sees all sorts of things. And that was the sort of first half an hour. And then at the end, he basically slagged off half a dozen people and told us why he doesn't like them. So that made some significant headlines, particularly his comments about Novak Djokovic and Rafael Nadal and Fernando Verdasco.
Suarez Navarro.
Yes, although he was very complimentary.
No, in a good
her,
way.
Yeah.
But I still found it very interesting.
It was interesting.
Loves her.
Yeah, he does. And then the following day, he went out onto the court against Casper Ruud. He had a good win in the first round against Daniil Medvedev, had Kyrgios, and he'd been talking about the style he'd played and the way...
Underarm serve on the first point.
Yeah, and he was really proud of that.
Yeah.
And he told Francis Tiafoe he would do it, and then he did it, and he won the point, so he was very happy. And then he played Casper Ruud. It was pretty...
He was loving it.
Well, not much was happening in the first set. It wasn't going very well. Then
he stuck with it. He didn't just go, oh, I don't fancy this, I'm out on court 3, I've lost the first set. He stuck with it, played himself into the match. He was fired up. The crowd were loving it. It was brilliant. was into it.
Leveled the match.
I sent the Tennis Podcast WhatsApp group going, I simply can't believe, as per his comments on No Challenges Remaining, I can't believe that he just flat out doesn't enjoy tennis. Because that was the sight of a man enjoying himself.
Yeah, he was showing off to the crowd. They were absolutely loving that and all the rest of it. And then on our chat, you said, hold on, he's just smashed his racket into the ground. He's just flung a chair across the court. He's shaking hands and he's walking off. And he simultaneously retired and got defaulted. Jerry Armstrong coming out onto the court. Kyrgios actually shook hands both with his opponent, the umpire, and Jerry Armstrong, and then walked off.
It was notable for me how quickly Jerry Armstrong appeared courtside, almost as if he had been loitering in expectation of something eventful.
Jerry Armstrong, who was responsible for defaulting John McEnroe in 1991 at the Australian Open, he was in the chair at the time, and now he's referee.
He can smell a crisis.
Yes, there are not too many situations Jerry hasn't come across over his career. It seemed to be sparked by somebody in the crowd who Kyrgios ended up having a row with, and then he got given a points penalty, then a game penalty, then he went really, he lost it, and the chair went flying, and we've had headlines for 24 hours and more since then. The usual kind of analysis of whether that makes him bad for the game, good for the game, should he be fined, suspended. He ended up getting, I think, a total of about 55,000 fine if you count the prize money he didn't get paid.
Had to pay for his own meals.
Yeah, had to get his own hotel, all that sort of thing. 55,000 euros, I think, was the total of the fine if you count everything up. There were three lots of 7,000 fines for his various point penalties, game penalties, etc.
The ATP deemed that his actions neither were injurious to the tournament nor brought the game into disrepute, because those are the two circumstances under which they can impose subsequent sort of after the fact extra penalties.
And the incident he'd had in Shanghai a couple of years ago was deemed not to be something that this would add on to. It was a separate offence. Back then he'd had, I think, an 8-week suspension, and he was told he had to get some sports psychology sessions, and this was a separate incident, so that's where we ended up with. Roger Federer said afterwards, what did he do? Injure a chair, as though it was not anything that required any special treatment. He said that the fines and the various things we've just described were enough. Casper Ruud, the opponent, had said, I think there's a lot of people that think he should be suspended for 6 months. Plenty of people defended him. Plenty of people attacked him. What do you think?
I sort of think all of those things at once. I think that, well, should we deal with the interview first, or do they go hand in hand? Are we dealing with them? Are they related?
Well,
I do
feel it is possible that the interview and the things he said could have almost prompted what he ended up doing
because of the backlash, because he absolutely knew he was going to get backlash. There was a moment in that interview, and I think his agent, it sounded to me like his agent tried to intervene, and you heard him say, mate, I've come this far, I'm pressing. And I think it was just as he was starting to go for his fellow players. I think he was just about to lay into Novak Djokovic, and there was sort of a pause, and then you heard him say, no mate, I've come this far.
Well, Todd Woodbridge said today on Channel 9 that he thinks that there is a direct relationship, and that he puts so much pressure on himself by giving the amount of candour in his interview that he did, that he can't handle that then in the situation when it gets tense on the court, and it caused him to blow. Which was very interesting in itself, I thought. I don't think that's impossible. I think that is possible.
Yeah, I mean, a cause and effect with Kyrgios is so impossible to identify, because frankly, I'm not sure any of us can even go any kind of meaningful way to understanding him and the workings of his brain. I mean, in terms of the interview, there was there were some things he said that, as you say, were so wonderfully self-reflective and charming and interesting, and as much as they might have been annoying, the very fact that he was so aware of them makes it sort of charming. It's like he it's not enough for him to achieve something. It only means something to him if he can look cool while he's doing it. Cool seems to be absolute ultimate aim.
He said, I do look in the mirror and I think, is this a front? Am I putting this on or not?
It was the fatalism and the determinism of his attitude to life which made me quite sad. He sort of said, yeah, this is how I am. And, you know, as we're saying, really a real self-awareness in his description of himself and how he is and his deficiencies and his flaws. But he just accepts those and says, I can't change him. This is how I am. Of course you can. Of course you can. You just have to want to. If you don't like that about yourself, if it's not making you happy, which is what he's saying, I'm not happy doing this, then identify the things that are making you unhappy, the things about, I mean, we're getting awfully deep here, but that fatalism made me really sad.
I agree with you on many levels. I still listen to him and watch what's happening with him and think, well, but is that under his control? Is he wired in a way that can take control of it at all? I'm not sure he can.
No, not currently.
I'm not even sure he can want
to. But you can seek help to rewire.
If you fully understand, you know.
There are ways to rewire. His approach to life at the moment is one of self-sabotage and sadism, and I agree with you, he doesn't know any other way, but there is help available, and I think he does need help, and I think he's unhappy. I don't think somebody that's happy acts the way that we saw out there.
Listening to the interview, and look, props to Ben for getting the interview and etc. Some people say, oh, I don't think we should be praising an interview like that. I see it on a couple of levels. I think it was fascinating to listen to. I do feel a bit uncomfortable with elements of it, and that's not to say I wouldn't have done the interview. Had I had the chance, I probably would. There are elements to it, though, that make me uncomfortable, and I actually got in touch with somebody at the ATP to ask, is there any sort of kind of fitness test mentally that players are required to go through before they take to the court and join the tour? And it was pointed out to me there is support out there, and
what specifically?
I think that there is. Don't forget, when he had what he had previously, he was given access to a psychologist, which is available. I think that there is an understanding that mental health is increasingly something that people are aware of within the game and need to be. And I'm not sure it's sufficient, but I certainly wouldn't say there's a totally blind eye to it. But the point that was made to me is, how can you help somebody that doesn't want to be helped? Well, and that's very difficult. I do see the problem there. What do you do? You're saying, sorry, you can't come on the court. We don't think you're in a fit state to. It's who makes that call? Very difficult.
Yeah. I don't know. I don't know. I don't know the answers. And he said in the interview that he deliberately surrounds himself with people that don't challenge him, you know, that for all the right reasons, because they care about him, etc., they enable him, aren't they? They're kind of enablers. They're not people that are going to walk out of the door if he behaves badly or...
No, and I mean, look, I know one of them who... I know tries to get him to do the right things, etc. Yeah. But there, I don't think there are those sort of ultimatums. No, they care about him. That's the thing. They want him to be okay. And it's, look,
maybe he does just have to be accepted as he is, and unless there isn't necessarily a one size tennis player fits all, and if you break the rules you get fined, you get this, that, the other, and there is the other side that there's a lot of people that were noticed in the sport. I feel so conflicted about all of it. I really do.
And so much of the reaction to him lacks any kind of nuance. That's what really bothers me. Some people will say, oh, it's so ridiculous that everyone's coming down on Nick Kyrgios like a ton of bricks for this. Just let him do his thing. And some people will say, this is absolutely appalling. He needs to be banned from the game for a year. Absolutely no sympathy with him whatsoever.
It's all those things.
You can't have a binary response to Nick Kyrgios. It's simply not possible.
No. So I don't really know where we are.
I mean, it is possible, evidently, but it's not right.
Yeah, it doesn't sit right with me either. So, there we are. we've got absolutely nowhere.
What I can say confidently is that Nick Kyrgios is not going to win the French Open.
I agree. that's our prediction here on the Tennis Podcast, and we'll be making similar wonderful predictions in our newsletter, which you can sign up to. And that just about does it for this particular edition in the car.
Is this our first car edition?
Think so. We've done the bus at the US Open. We've done the walk to the bus. We've done the walking into a tree while walking to the bus show. That happened as well. So we've done lots of different things over the course of the last... You know, it's our 7th birthday coming up this week.
It's the 28th, isn't it?
Something like that, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so 7 years of the Tennis Podcast. And
we're open to being sent cake.
We are. Thanks for listening to all of you. Do tell your friends if you've enjoyed this show, and if there's somebody you think might enjoy it, let them know so we can keep introducing more people to it. Hopefully they'll enjoy it too. We are going to have another show in a few days' time in the lead up to Roland Garros. The French Open is on the horizon. Catherine is going to be there for Eurosport. I never get to go because I'm always too busy at the Queen's Club, but she'll be there working for Eurosport as part of their team. But our show, our new show coming out in a few days' time, is going to be Rafael Nadal, an oral history. It will see Catherine, myself, and Matt Roberts going through his career in some detail, reflecting on our memories and great moments from his career, challenges he's faced, all sorts of stuff, trying to give our insight from our dealings with him, and generally telling the story of Rafael Nadal.
A delve into the David Law memory bank.
Yes, it's vast and usually pointless. However, it does have the odd nugget. Then we will be daily, of course, at Roland Garros for the French Open. Our daily tennis podcasts will continue throughout. Matt's going to be there. Grad Matt is going to be there for the first week, accredited for us. That's good, isn't it?
It's great.
Very exciting. And we are brought to you in association with The Telegraph. We are executive produced by tennisballs.com. Our mascot is Rio with a Y, and we'll speak to you soon.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.